back home, and the stigma and expectation of failure from the larger society. If I make a mistake, my community makes a mistake, he said. If I fall, the community falls. I walk a very thin line. Back home in India, when the scholar goes into a store, they watch him and hound him like a thief, as with a black person in a store in America. He has absorbed that expectation and adjusted to it to survive. I never ask about the quality of an item, the scholar said. I ask the price. If I ask the quality, they will say, "You can't afford this. Why are you wasting my time?" If I say I want to see it, they will say, "Get out. I will call the police." So I come back with friends who are not Dalit, who can speak their language and get it for me. It is for that reason that he stood there in the lobby of a high-end hotel after a dinner near campus and pointed to his shoes, his leather-clad sneakers. He bent down and pressed the empty toe box of his sneakers. "These shoes I bought," he said. "They are not my size. They are too big for me. I bought them because I did not want to trouble the salesman. I did not have the confidence to ask for another size. So I bought what he gave me." He, like subordinate caste people wherever there is caste, has had to create an entire protocol to protect himself from insult. "If I go into a store and stay 30 minutes, I have to buy something," he said. "I have so many things that I was afraid to return." Dalits have suffered brutal assaults for caste infractions, forbidden even today in the rural precincts from walking the same roads as the dominant caste. A family in the Vellore district was forced to carry a deceased loved one along the back roads to reach the funeral pyre. The men had to lower the body, wrapped in cloth and leaves, by a rope from a bridge, the body dangling on descent, as the men below stretched their arms up to receive it. They had been denied access to public roads that they would have been seen as polluting. They do what they must to avoid further insult. "For us, it is dignity," he said. "If I go someplace, they might say, 'You can't afford this. You are wasting my time.' So when I go to a restaurant, I don't want to take up the waiter's time. They might attack us, and then they say that we are hostile, when for us it is a matter of dignity. Our dignity is under assault." He once accompanied two white American women to a store and was astonished at their behavior. "They took up the owner's time and did not buy anything," he said. "I could not imagine doing that." The fear runs deep within his soul. I asked him, "Is this fear of anticipated rejection or the actual rejection itself?" "It is the former caused by the latter," he answered. "What would help you feel better in these situations?" I asked him. "What I need is to feel better inside my own skin," he said. Chapter 23. Shock Troops on the Borders of Hierarchy. At the dinner hour on a 19th century steamboat in the antebellum South, the caste ritual went as follows. At the first bell, the white passengers were seated with the captain for their meal. After they finished, the second bell rang for the white crewmen, the engineers, the pilot, the servants. Only after all of the white people on board, of every class and status, completed their meals, would the third bell ring, and the black crewman, slave or free, be permitted to eat. A problem arose, however, if there happened to be free black passengers in their midst. Free blacks paid their fare and were on paper in the same category as the white passengers. They were likely middle class, but what mattered was that they were the lowest caste, and historically, caste trumps class. It was taboo for blacks and whites to sit, stand, or eat in the same space at the same time, or even to use the same utensils. So they were not going to eat with their white counterparts, or with the white crewmen, who were presumably lower in class than they. But there was more to it than that. Free blacks were an affront to the caste system, always brushing against its borders. By their very existence, moving about as equals to the dominant caste, having the means to enter spaces considered the preserve of their betters, and having had the ingenuity to gain their freedom and to walk around in it, they threw the entire caste belief system into question. If people in the lowest caste had the capacity to be equal, why were they being enslaved? If they were smart enough to do something other than pick cotton or scrub floors, why then were they picking cotton and scrubbing floors? It was too mind-twisting to contemplate. After the dinner service was cleared away and everyone else aboard had eaten and retired to their cabins or posts, the small group of black passengers, all women in this case, were permitted to eat in the pantry, standing at the butler's table. From the start of the caste system in America, people who were lowest caste but who had managed somehow to rise above their station have been the shock troops on the front lines of hierarchy. People who appear in places or positions where they are not expected can become foot soldiers in an ongoing quest for respect and legitimacy in a fight they had hoped was long over. Public conveyances and recreational spaces have been the soundstage for caste confrontation precisely because they bring together in a confined space for a limited time and purpose groups that have historically been kept apart. They become test tubes of caste interaction with its written and unwritten codes, its unspoken but understood rules of engagement. In 2015, the members of a black women's book club were traveling by train on a wine tour of Napa Valley. They were laughing and chatting, as were other tourists, given the nature of the outing and what all the passengers had been imbibing. But they alone seemed to attract the notice of the maitre d'. "When you laugh," the maitre d' told them, "I see it on the other passengers' faces." Soon the train stopped, and the black women, some of them senior citizens, were ejected and met by police as if we were criminals, they later said. In 2018, the owner of a Pennsylvania golf club ordered black women club members to leave and called the police on them after white golfers complained that they were not moving fast enough. The women described themselves as experienced players, aware of the game's protocols, and said they had paced themselves according to the groups behind and in front of them. They said they noted that the men behind them were on break and were not ready to tee up. After arriving on the scene, the police determined that no charges were warranted, but the women said the confrontation had put them on edge, and they left to avoid further humiliation. My work has required me to spend many, many hours in settings where I am often the only person of my ethnicity and gender, most often on planes. A flight attendant once commented on the miles I log year in and year out. "You fly more than we do." Because I fly so often, I frequently have cause to be seated in first or business class, which can turn me into a living, breathing social experiment without wanting to be. The things that have happened to me are far from the most grievous a person might suffer when traveling in a domain that can bring out the worst in most anyone. But some have stood out as a commentary on caste in action and can be demoralizing in the unexpected moment of intrusion. For a flight out of Denver, I happened to be one of the first to board the plane, along with others in the front cabin. I could see the lead flight attendant greeting passengers at the boarding door. He was a man in his late 20s or early 30s, short blondish hair, and behind him was a second flight attendant, her brunette hair in a French twist. The tendonitis in my wrist had been flaring up, and as I stepped onto the plane with a splint on my forearm, I looked over to the lead flight attendant for help with my carry-on. "Sir," I said, "I'm having a problem with my wrist, and I wonder if you would help me get my bag in the bin." He looked past me to the men behind me at the boarding door, the kind of men who would come to mind when you think of first class. He waved me along, as if I were holding up the line, though no one was moving at the moment. He seemed insulted even to have been asked, as if I was not aware of how the boarding process worked. "There are two flight attendants in the back," he said. "They can help you when you get back there." With those curt instructions, it was as if he had pulled me out of a lineup, singled me out from the other business travelers as the one who, on sight, did not belong, the one trespassing and now seeking special treatment to which I was not entitled. Marginalized people have a hard enough time moving about in a world built for others. Now it was as if I were taking up space that belonged to its rightful passengers. It came as a shock to me, perhaps because this clipped dismissal came from a man whose generation would not be expected to hold such retrograde assumptions. Somehow the air had turned confrontational. I had asked for something he did not believe I deserved. "But I'm in first," I said. That seemed only to make things worse. He had been caught in his moment of stereotyping and in front of others. He had disregarded all information inputs to the contrary, that I was boarding early, that luggage tags dangling from the bag I was seeking help with proclaimed that I had reached the highest possible level of loyalty to his airline. He could only have come to the conclusion he made on the basis of one thing alone, what I looked like. He tried to recover from the faux pas of an openly dismissive caste assumption, for what is caste if not where one belongs in a hierarchy? He had to find a way to retain his own caste position, now that a flight attendant under him in the airline's hierarchy had heard him speak so brusquely to a passenger, wherever she happened to be seated. "Well, leave it here, and we'll have to see what to do with it," he said, sighing, as if it were a bass violin instead of a rolling bag. The woman flight attendant who stood there during the exchange stepped forward and tried to set things right, cover for him, her superior. "Here," she said, "let me help you with it. What seat are you in?" She walked me to the seat and helped me hoist the bag into the bin. I thanked her for her kindness. It was uncomfortable the rest of the flight. He was the only attendant in that cabin, and each time he passed through the aisle, the tension rose. I could feel the edge of it. He had been outed, and he punished me with a curt hostility until we landed. It was a late-night flight from Portland, Oregon to the East Coast. I had just boarded, and the flight attendant and I were looking for space to fit my roller bag into the haphazardly filled overhead compartments. Each time the flight attendant and I touched a bag to turn it on its side or to move it to the next bin, someone said, "No, you can't touch that one, that's my bag." The man in the aisle seat behind me had two carry-ons overhead, taking up more space than allowed. I was anxious to get seated and out of this uncomfortable testing of wills. I offered to let him put his bag under my seat so that it would not take up space in front of him. Anything to get the bag stored and get on our way. "I'd be glad to do it," I told him and the flight attendant. He let out a heavy breath. "I put my bag where I wanted it. I don't want it under another seat." He took the bag from the flight attendant and shoved it under his own seat. He then began complaining to the man in the window seat beside him, a man like him from the dominant caste, seated directly behind me. "That's what happens when they let just anybody in first class," the owner of the bag said to the man next to him, loud enough for anyone around us to hear. "They should know better how to treat paying customers. I paid for my first class ticket, and this is how they treat you." The two men commiserated the whole flight, having found common cause and united by a shared resentment. It was a night flight, and I was exhausted from a long day of lectures. I needed to sleep. I let down the seat back. What did I do that for? The man in the window seat behind me, who had been grousing about the unfairness of it all with the man whose bag had been moved, let out a howl. "What do you think you're doing?" he yelled. "I'm trying to work here. Look what you've done. I've got my laptop out, and you've shoved it into me." He slammed the back of my seat and pounded the tray forward, jostling me as he continued to hit from behind. "I had no control over the seat back," I told him, looking back. "I'm just trying to get some rest." I looked over at the white man next to me, who had seen all of this, who would have felt the shudder of my seat being pushed from behind. He would not return a glance, isolating me further. The men behind me continued to talk about the intrusions into first class. The air was thick with venom and made it impossible to sleep. I got up to tell the flight attendant to see if she might be able to help. "I am desperately tired and I need to sleep," I told her. "The man behind me is shoving my seat and making it impossible to get rest. Is there anything you could do? Could you explain the rules to him to defuse the situation?" "Frankly, I don't know if it would help," she said. "Why don't you stay up here the rest of the flight?" "I need to rest," I told her. "I can't sleep standing up here. And besides, I have a seat, and I should be able to sit in it." "I know," she said. "I don't know what to tell you. It's up to you if you want to stay up here or go back." I went back and sat up straight across the length of the country. The caste system had put me in my place. I had been up since before 5 a.m. for the flight out of Idaho Falls. The original flight was canceled, the second one delayed, and now finally, I was on the last leg of the journey, the connecting flight out of Salt Lake City that would not get me in until 10:30 p.m. I was in seat 2D, a window in first, the only passenger in that cabin who was African-American. The lead attendant was a black man, small in frame, cheerful and efficient. "What are you having, my friend?" he asked the male passengers as he chatted them up. "And you," he said, terse and impatient when he got to me. Upon landing, the mad shuffle began for everyone's respective bag in the overhead compartments. Passengers crowded into the aisle, and I was standing behind a man who looked to be in his 30s, his light hair in a buzz cut. He asked a woman next to him if she needed help with her bag. He pulled it down for her, and she thanked him. Then he began to reach for his own bag. It was in the compartment above and behind me. He did not speak nor gesture in my direction. Instead, he reached back and up and over me, wordlessly leaned farther and farther, his body at a backward angle against mine, pinning me under his torso and leaving me no escape because of the wall of passengers packed behind me. I was in disbelief, forced to arch my body back as he rammed himself harder against me, heavy and sweaty, shifting his feet now, shoving his thick arm across my face and against the side of my neck to unloosen the bag from the compartment. He thrust his full weight, his entire frame, into mine, his back muscles crushing my breasts, his buttocks protruding into my pelvis, violating my body in full view of other passengers. And no one was saying or doing a thing. "Hey, I can't go back any further," I told him in a plea for help, loud enough for everyone around me to hear. He said nothing, as if I were not there, as if nobody were there, as if the laws of physics or privacy did not apply. I tried to hold my head away from his shoulder blades so that I could breathe. It was taking the ground crew forever to open the boarding door. I looked around for whoever would recognize the horror of a complete stranger forcing himself onto you. I looked over to the two young women who were inches away and who could see what he was doing. I gave them a look of distress and shock at the man's aggression. I was needing empathy. They were standing so close, they could share a sense of womanly outrage at what was happening. But their faces were blank. They looked into space, returned no glance. A silence of complicity had overtaken the entire first-class cabin, and I was alone in a packed compartment. Not one of these passengers would have lost their job or a promotion, lost money or privilege, had they stood up that day. Very likely, they would never see these other passengers again in their lives, and stepping up would have had no material consequences. But that day, with so very little at stake to themselves, they chose caste solidarity over principle, tribe over empathy. The boarding door finally opened, the passengers filed out, and the man finally eased his behind off of me. The black flight attendant, who had seen all of it, had not come to my aid nor spoken up, though he was the flight attendant in charge. As I approached the door, he looked up at me, sheepish and shamefaced. "I'm really sorry," he said. "Thanks, I know," I said, shaking my head. He hadn't intervened. He, too, seemed powerless. He couldn't likely have taken the risk. This was an upper caste man assaulting a lower caste woman, and the lead attendant was lower caste himself. The lead attendant very likely had no idea what the man's position might be, what power and influence he might have had. Why should he stick his neck out for me and get on the bad side of heaven knows who? The man had bullied me out in the open, with witnesses all around who pretended not to see. The lead attendant likely felt it would do him no good to get involved. In a caste system, things work more smoothly when everyone stays in their place, and that is what he did. I was shaking and livid. Once off the plane and out in the terminal, the man who had forced me into a vertical spoon with him in front of an audience was walking with a brisk swagger several paces ahead of me. He knew full well what he had done. Cocking his head back at me, he spat out a curt, "Sorry," and kept walking with the entitlement that comes from knowing he could get away with it. There would be no consequences. Not one person had stepped to my defense or shown a blink of compassion. A host of factors might have made things different. Perhaps it was the lateness of the hour that inured some people. Maybe it was just the singular combination of personalities that left me without anyone to stand up to it. Change one or two seats with different people, and there might have been a different outcome. One thing seems certain. Had an African-American man pressed his body against a white woman the way this man had, it is hard to imagine that no one on board would have intervened, if only to say to him, "I'll get your bag for you so you can get off of her." Over the course of American history, black men have died for doing far less to white women than what he did to me that night. You might say, "Why didn't you complain to the airline? Why didn't you tell him off?" Those questions belie the situation. This was not the fault of the airline. As for the man who did this, he ignored my protests of his behavior. This happened because good people were silent and let it happen. I was too disgusted to reply as the man swaggered ahead of me. I made my way to the other side of the passenger walkway and continued until he was out of my sight. Incursions such as these are more than personal insults and unfortunate misunderstandings. Fighting convention, fighting to be seen and treated for who you truly are, diminishes the human contract demeans everyone, and worsens the well-being of people on all sides of these caste skirmishes. The most brazen cases lead to violence, a hallmark of a caste system at the breaking point. In 2013, on a flight to Atlanta, a white passenger actually slapped a black baby in the face because the baby was crying due to the change in altitude upon descent. Such an assault would be virtually inconceivable had a baby from the dominant caste been crying, no matter his decibel level. In 2017, a Vietnamese-American passenger was dragged off a United Airlines plane in Chicago, suffering injuries to his head and knocking out some of his teeth. The airline had discovered that it had overbooked the flight, and no passenger took the airline up on offers of compensation in exchange for giving up their seats. The airline chose four passengers, at random by computer, to be ejected. The first three passengers left the plane without incident, but the Vietnamese-American man, a physician named David Dao, said he had an urgent need to get back to his patients. He said he had paid his fare and should not have to give up his seat. The airline called security to remove him, and he was dragged by his legs in front of stunned passengers. Captured on a video that quickly went viral, the incident drew outrage across the country and in Asia. Dao said he was convinced that his ethnicity was a factor in his treatment, that this would not have happened to a white man of his or most any other stature. The ordeal, he said, was more horrifying than when he fled Vietnam. Even 3 years later, watching the video of his violent removal again, he told ABC News, "I just cried." Chapter 24. Cortisol, telomeres, and the lethality of caste. A young man emigrated from Nigeria at the age of 17 to attend college in the United States. His father paid the tuition, and at the end of the first semester, the young man went to pick up the refund at the bursar's office. "You speak very good English," the clerk told him. The Nigerian man excoriated the clerk. "Of course I speak good English," he said. "I speak English better than many Americans. I speak other languages as well. Don't ever say that again." He discovered that in America, he was not seen for his skills or his education. He was seen as black before anything else. It was an identity he was unaccustomed to, that had no meaning back home, where everyone had similar coloring. Now it seemed to mean everything. The African Americans were always talking about being profiled and mistreated, and he hadn't paid it much attention at first. But the longer he was in the United States, the more he shed his accent, as immigrants often do, and the more Americanized he became, the more he began to experience life not as an immigrant, not solely as a Nigerian, but as a black man in a hierarchy that disfavored people who looked like him. Women clenched their purses as he approached, shrank from him on the elevator, crossed the street to avoid passing near him. He was followed in stores as if he were a felon, and the authorities questioned him more intensely than he was accustomed to, more intensely than the white men, he noticed. A white driver locked her door when he merely drove up in traffic one day. He went and locked his door too, to show that he was as concerned for his safety as she was. He found himself passed over for promotions as a compliance officer, and despite his seniority and experience, he was laid off. And he wondered, as many people assigned to the subordinate caste cannot help but consider, if race had anything to do with it. Before coming to America, he would have thought it preposterous. Maybe the African Americans were not working hard enough, were not educated enough. Now, having lived longer in the United States than in Nigeria, he knew better than to dismiss what they said out of hand. Once, when he pulled into a parking space, an older white woman whose car he had parked next to, turned and stared, then recoiled backward in her driver's seat. "I see her," he told the passenger in the car with him. "I don't give a shit." Except actually, he did, or rather his physiology did. Modern medicine has long sought to attribute the higher rates of disease in African Americans relative to white Americans to genetics. But it turns out that sub-Saharan Africans do not have high rates of high blood pressure, diabetes, and heart disease, while African Americans have the highest rates of those conditions of all ethnic groups in the United States. The Nigerian man now living in America was living this too. "My father lived to 90 years old," the man said. "He had no high blood pressure until the last day of his life. I just went to the doctor, and he tells me I have high blood pressure and early signs of diabetes," he said, "and I am just 54. The effects of spending my entire adult life as a black man in this country are making me sick 40 years ahead of my own father back in Nigeria." The friction of caste is killing people. Societal inequity is killing people. The act of moving about and navigating spaces with those whom society has trained us to believe are inherently different from us is killing people, and not just the targets. Studies are showing that prejudice itself can be deadly. Neuroscientists have found that harboring this kind of animus can raise a person's blood pressure and cortisol levels, even during benign social interactions with people of different races, wrote the neuropsychologist Elizabeth Page Gould. Prejudice itself can be deadly. These physical reactions can put the person at greater risk for stroke or diabetes or heart attacks and premature death. A study of white Americans who scored high on a measure of automatic prejudice, meaning the degree to which they associate certain ethnic groups with negative stereotypes at the level of the unconscious, found that when they were put into situations where they were, for example, to be interviewed for a job by an African American or to have social interaction with Latinos, they perceived the people of a different ethnicity as a threat, even in a safe laboratory setting. The threat they perceived as a result of their prejudice set off their body's alarm system. Their panic produced automatic physiological responses, as would occur if they were in combat or confronting an oncoming car. Restricted blood flow to the heart, the flooding of the muscles with glucose as the body releases cortisol, the hormone useful in the rare moment when one might need to escape danger, but damaging to the body on a regular basis. The combination of reduced blood flow, constrictions to the circulatory and digestive systems, and the breakdown of muscle by cortisol can lead to life-threatening damage to the heart and the immune system, and to death before one's time. Even the briefest exposure is all it takes to activate the body's response. Among whites, the sight of a black person, even in faded yearbook photographs, can trigger the amygdala of the brain to perceive threat and arm itself for vigilance within 30 milliseconds of exposure, the blink of an eye, researchers have found. When whites have a bit more time for the conscious mind to override the automatic feeling of threat, the amygdala activity switches to inhibition mode. When whites are prompted to think of the black person as an individual, imagine their personal characteristics, the threat level falls. This shows that it is possible to override our worst impulses and reduce these prejudices, wrote the psychologist Susan Fiske. But to do so in a meaningful way requires forethought, an awareness of the unconscious biases passed down through the generations, and the chance for people different from one another to work together as equals on the same team with shared goals that require cooperation to succeed, Fiske said. Outside of sports and the military, American society provides few such opportunities. This leaves many Americans at risk without knowing it. As they go about their days interacting with coworkers, neighbors, contractors, or other ordinary people perceived as unlike themselves, they can be in danger of worsened health and premature illness due to the threat signals triggered by the person's own unaddressed prejudice. On the other side of the caste system, scientists have connected a key indicator of health and longevity, the length of human telomeres, to one's exposure to inequality and discrimination, primarily focusing on the telomere lengths of African Americans. A telomere is a repeating sequence of double-stranded DNA at the end of a chromosome. The more frequently a cell divides, the shorter the telomeres become, wearing out the cell in a process that public health scientist Arlene Geronimus in her pioneering 1992 work termed weathering. It is a measure of premature aging of the cells, and thus of the person bearing those cells, and of the early onset of disease due to chronic exposure to such stressors as discrimination, job loss, or obesity. These studies initially focused on the accelerated aging of the telomeres of African Americans, but expanded research is finding that this kind of cell damage results from one's exposure to social inequity and difficult life conditions, rather than merely one's race and ethnicity. Thus, the telomeres of poor whites, for example, are shorter than those of wealthier whites, whose resources might better help them weather life's challenges. The opposite is true for people in the lower castes in America. Socioeconomic status and the presumed privilege that comes with it do not protect the health of well-to-do African Americans. In fact, many suffer a health penalty for their ambitions. Middle-class African American men and women are more likely to suffer from hypertension and stress than those with lower incomes, wrote the sociologist George Lipsitz. The stigma and stereotypes they labor under expose them to higher levels of stress-inducing discrimination in spite of, or perhaps because of, their perceived educational or material advantages. The pattern applies to another marginalized group, Mexicans in America. It turns out that poorer Mexican immigrants have longer telomeres, meaning healthier, younger cells, than better off Mexican Americans. Poorer Mexicans are likely to be newer to this country and to cluster together in closer support networks. Their isolation from the mainstream and the language barrier could inadvertently insulate them from the discrimination that more affluent Mexicans may face as they navigate the caste system on a daily basis. Those who were born in the United States or have lived in the country for many years would have greater exposure to the damaging effects of stereotyping and stigma. All of these groups appear to be paying a price when they step outside of the roles assigned them in the hierarchy. High levels of everyday discrimination contribute to narrowing the arteries over time, said the Harvard social scientist David R. Williams. High levels of discrimination lead to higher levels of inflammation, a marker of heart disease. People who face discrimination, Williams said, often build up a layer of unhealthy fat, known as visceral fat, surrounding vital organs, as opposed to subcutaneous fat just under the skin. It is this visceral fat that raises the risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease and leads to premature death. And it can be found in people of all ethnicities based on their experience of discrimination. Black women experience higher levels of discrimination than white women do, Williams said. But when white women experience discrimination, the effects are the same. So discrimination leading to higher levels of visceral fat, that is true for African American women and for white women. When whites report higher levels of discrimination, their health is also hurt. It really says something about the nature of human interaction. When it comes to life expectancy, middle-aged and less educated white Americans are experiencing a downward trend, as we have heard. But people of color at the bottom of the caste system, who bear the brunt of societal stigma, still have an overall lower life expectancy than their white counterparts at every level of education, according to Williams. The average white American at age 25 is likely to live 5 years longer than the average African American. While white high school dropouts have a lower life expectancy than their more educated white counterparts, they live 3 years longer than African American high school dropouts. And white college graduates live 4 years longer than African American college graduates. Thus, people of color with the most education, who compete in fields where they are not expected to be, continually press against the boundaries of caste and experience a lower life expectancy as a result. The more ambitious the marginalized person, the greater the risk of what evolutionary biologist Joseph L. Graves calls the out-of-place principle of social dominance. Graves found that hypertension rates of blacks and whites are roughly the same when affluent African Americans are deleted from the equation. The caste system takes years off the lives of subordinate caste people, the more they find themselves in contention with it. There is a black tax that we pay that hurts our health, and the gap is larger among the college educated than it is among high school dropouts, Williams said. We still carry that burden to engage in a heightened vigilance, which means you're careful of how you look, how you appear, how you dress. Williams had a friend, a middle-class black businessman, who would never leave the house in the sweats and sneakers that his white neighbors wore without a moment's thought. He couldn't afford to. He took great care whenever he left the house, and it took more time and more forethought for even the most casual errand. If his wife needed a gallon of milk and he needed to run to the supermarket to get that gallon of milk, he would run into the house to get a jacket and tie, Williams said. It was his way of trying to minimize the likelihood that he's going to be perceived as criminal because he's a young black male. That is what we live with, and it is taking a toll on our lives. It seems that people in the dominant caste know in their bones that the playing field tilts toward the group they happen to have been born to. Years ago, back in the 1990s, the political scientist Andrew Hacker posed a theoretical question to his white undergraduates at Queens College in New York. He asked them how much they would have to be paid to live the next 50 years as a black person. The students thought it over and came back with a figure. Most said they would need $50 million, $1 million for every year that they would have to be black. They felt they would need it, he said, to buy protection from the discriminations and dangers white people know they would face once they were perceived to be black. Part 6. Backlash. Chapter 25. A Change in the Script. The greatest departure from the script of the American caste system was the election of an African American to the highest office in the land. History has shown that there would be consequences to this disruption of the social order, and there were. What follows is not an analysis of the presidency of Barack Obama, but rather a look into the caste system's response to his ascension and the challenges it would place in his path. First, to break more than two centuries of tradition and birthright, it would take the human equivalent of a supernova, a Harvard-trained lawyer, a U.S. senator from the land of Lincoln, whose expertise was the Constitution itself, whose charisma and oratory matched or exceeded that of most any man who had ever risen to the Oval Office, whose unusual upbringing inclined him toward conciliation of the racial divide, who famously saw the country as not blue states or red states, but as the United States, whose wife, if it could be imagined, was also a Harvard-trained lawyer with as much star power as her husband, who together with their two young daughters made for a telegenic American dream family, and who, beyond all this, ran a scrupulous, near-flawless campaign. A movement, really. It would take an idealist who believed what most Americans would have sworn was impossible for a black man to make it to the White House. Secondly, his opponent, a beloved and aging war hero from Arizona, a wise and measured moderate Republican in a party that had grown more conservative, ran a less than energetic campaign and made several misjudgments, the most significant of which was choosing an unpredictable former governor of Alaska, a woman prone to gaffes and to quirky word salad misstatements, as his running mate. Then, in the months leading up to the election, a once-in-a-generation financial catastrophe descended on a country that seemed on the brink of financial ruin under the Republican administration then in power. Wall Street firms collapsed before our eyes, and the value of American homes, the primary source of many citizens' wealth, plunged in value, leaving millions of voters underwater. In October 2008, a few weeks before the election, envelopes arrived in the mailboxes of millions of American households, mailings that became inadvertent leaflets in favor of the Democrat. The quarterly 401k statements that showed losses of as much as 40% of people's savings in the last year under the Republican president. By that November, some 12 million homeowners owed more on their mortgages than their houses were worth in what was now being called the Great Recession, among the worst economic downturns since the Great Depression. People in the dominant caste, who might have been on the fence about taking a chance on an African-American candidate, were looking at massive losses with no end in sight. Hope had been Obama's mantra during times that badly needed it. A record tide of people from the lower and middle castes, people who swelled with pride and whose votes now felt like a mission, came out for him, and along with just enough dominant caste voters who believed in him too, swept Obama into the White House. The world was so joyous that a committee in Norway awarded him the Nobel Peace Prize within months of his inauguration. Only very rarely has a person to the same extent as Obama captured the world's attention, the Nobel Committee said, and given its people hope for a better future. Over the course of American history, the idea of a black man in the Oval Office was virtually unthinkable. But from a caste perspective and beyond his own personal gifts, his singular origin story was one that the caste system would be more willing to accept, if any. His growing up in Hawaii, the son of an immigrant from Kenya and of a white woman from Kansas, was free from the heaviness of slavery and Jim Crow and the hard histories of regular African Americans. His story did not trigger the immediate discomfort in the dominant caste, unlike those of everyday black people, who, if you scratch their family trees long enough, you run into a sharecropper cheated at settlement, or an ancestor shut out of a neighborhood because of redlining. People for whom these injustices were not history, but their own or their foreparents' actual lives. Rather, his origin story freed people in the dominant caste from having to think about the unsavory corners of American history. They could regard him with curiosity and wonderment, and even claim him as part of themselves if they chose. They could perhaps feel a connection to his mother and to his mother's mother, who tragically died just before Election Day. Both women were from the dominant caste and would not get to see how very far he would go in this world. The Delaware senator who would become his running mate, though, seemed to be speaking, however awkwardly, for some others in the ruling majority. You've got the first sort of mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy, said Joe Biden. I mean, that's a storybook, man. After the election, white Americans in both parties extolled the progress the country had made in the past generation, relieved to be able to say that racism was a thing of the past. We have a black president, for heaven's sakes, they would say, by way of example. The fact is, though, this was a development that the majority of the dominant caste was not truly in a position to claim. The majority of white voters did not support him in either of his presidential bids. He had star power and a way with babies and pensioners. But no matter how refined and inspirational, well-spoken and conciliatory he was, Obama's victory did not occur because most voters in the dominant caste had become more open-minded and enamored of him. As with other recent Democrats running for president, he won despite the bulk of the white electorate. Even as they proclaimed a new post-racial world, the majority of white Americans did not vote for the country's first black president. An estimated 43% went for him in 2008. Thus, a solid majority of white Americans, nearly 3 out of every 5 white voters, did not back him in his first election, and fewer still, 39% voted for him in 2012. In the former Confederate state of Mississippi, only 1 in 10 white voters pulled the lever for Obama. For much of his presidency, he was trying to win over people who did not want him in the Oval Office, and some who resented his very existence. As a measure of the enduring role of caste interests in American politics, the shadow of the Civil War seemed to hang over the 2008 election. It turned out that Obama carried every state that Abraham Lincoln had won in 1860, an election with an almost entirely white electorate, but one that became a proxy for egalitarian sentiment and for the future of slavery and of the Republic. The cultural divides of the Civil War on racial grounds, wrote the political scientist Patrick Fisher of Seton Hall University, can thus still be considered to be influencing American political culture a century and a half later. Lyndon B. Johnson, after signing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, is said to have predicted that the Democrats would lose the South for a generation for having stood up for the citizenship rights of African Americans. That prophecy would prove to be correct, but also an understatement. The Democrats would lose more than just the South, and for well longer than a generation. From that moment forward, white Americans overall moved rightward toward the Republicans as the country enacted more egalitarian policies. In the more than half century since that prophecy of 1964, no Democrat running for president has ever won a majority of the white vote. Lyndon Johnson was the last Democrat to win the presidency with a majority of the white electorate. Since that time, the Democrat who came closest, who attracted the largest percentage of white voters at 48%, was fellow Southerner Jimmy Carter in 1976. Only 3 Democrats have made it to the Oval Office since the Johnson and the Civil Rights era: Carter, Obama, and Bill Clinton, who won with 39% of the white vote in 1992 and 44% in 1996. With whites pulling away from the Democrats and accustomed to prevailing in presidential elections through their sheer numbers, the outcome of the 2008 election was seen not merely as the defeat of John McCain, but perhaps a defeat of the historic ruling majority itself, a challenge to the absoluteness of whites' dominance, wrote the political scientist Ashley Jardina of Duke University, who specializes in the behavior of the white electorate. Combined with census projections of an end of the white majority by 2042, Obama's victory signaled that the dominant caste could undergo a not altogether certain, but still unthinkable wane in power over the destiny of the United States and over the future of themselves and their children and their sovereign place in the world. The symbolism of Obama's election was a profound loss to white status, Giardina wrote. This was something that no one in the dominant caste, or any other group in the country for that matter, had ever had to contemplate. It meant that people who had always been first now had to consider the potential loss of their centrality. For many, the ability of a black person to supplant the racial caste system, wrote the political scientist Andra Gillespie of Emory University, was the manifestation of a nightmare which would need to be resisted. That sense of fear and loss, however remote, brought to the fore for many whites, Giardina wrote, a sense of commonality, attachment, and solidarity with their racial group, a sense of needing to band together to protect their place in the hierarchy. The caste system sprang into action against this threat to the pre-existing order. The single most important thing we want to achieve, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, on the eve of the midterm elections in 2010, is for President Obama to be a one-term president. The opposition party would not succeed in denying him a second term, but would obstruct virtually every proposal he made and force him to resort to executive orders to accomplish his aims. Within 9 months of his inauguration, the president was addressing a joint session of Congress on his health care plan when a heckler interrupted an ordinarily staid affair of pomp and ritual by yelling, "You lie!" The outburst came from a Republican congressman from South Carolina, Joe Wilson. It was considered so out of order that the House of Representatives passed a resolution of disapproval against Wilson, and Senator John McCain, the Republican who lost to Obama in 2008, declared that there was no place for it in that setting or any other. In early 2012, Air Force One landed just outside Phoenix for a presidential visit to a manufacturing plant in Arizona, a routine stop at the start of an election year in which the president would be seeking a second term. There on the tarmac to greet the president was Jan Brewer, the state's Republican governor. The encounter quickly turned tense for such a moment of formality. As the wind rustled the tarmac, the governor, blonde and slight of build, handed the president an envelope, and soon she was looking stern and agitated at him. She jabbed her finger at the leader of the free world, inches from his nose, her mouth in mid-yell, like a principal scolding a child facing detention. In the photograph of their encounter, the president appears calm and stoic, if slightly bemused, which had been his usual demeanor, as she sticks her finger in his face as if to be saying, "And another thing, in some countries and with previous presidents, this might be seen as an act of aggression, a threat to a nation's head of state, a display of profound disrespect were it to happen at all." The photograph would become one of the defining images of the opposition and resentment President Obama faced in office. The difference in the accomplishments of these two people would not have been apparent from the optics of who was chastising whom. While the president was a graduate of Columbia and of Harvard Law School and had made a methodical march from state senator to U.S. senator to the Oval Office, the woman with the temerity to point her finger in his face had a 2-year certificate as a radiology technician and had risen to the governor's mansion by accident of succession after having been secretary of state. She was now a governor, 1 out of 50, compared to the U.S. president, the highest office in the land, and the most powerful in the world. But Governor Brewer was from the dominant caste, her birth-ascribed status seen as inherently above his, and she did not shrink from a gesture that had the look of putting a man from the subordinate caste in his place, no matter his station. The disagreement on the tarmac had presumably arisen over a passage in a book she had written, in which she described a meeting the two of them had had some time before, a depiction that he considered inaccurate. In it, she had complained that he thought he could lecture me and I would learn at his knee. The envelope she handed him was an invitation to see the Arizona border with Mexico, given that they had differing views on border security. Afterward, Governor Brewer denied what everyone could see. "I was not hostile," she told reporters. "I was trying to be very, very gracious." She went as far as to say that it was, in fact, she who felt unsafe. "I felt a little bit threatened, if you will, in the attitude that he had," she said, "even though the exchange had been in full view of cameras and Secret Service and elected officials, and despite the fact that it was she, after all, who was wagging her finger in his face, not the other way around." The encounter put the governor in the spotlight for the moment, and she used it to raise money for her political action committee, according to news reports at the time, and to fire up her base. She told potential donors that the message she was really giving the president that day was, "You have one more year." An entire machinery had moved into place upon the arrival of the first head of state from the subordinate caste. A new party of right-wing detractors arose in his wake, the Tea Party, vowing to take our country back. A separate movement of skeptics, who would come to be known as birthers, challenged the legitimacy of his citizenship and required him to produce an original birth certificate that they still chose to disbelieve. His opponents called him the food stamp president and depicted the president and the first lady as simians. At opposition rallies, people brandished guns and bore signs calling for death to Obama. In response to his election, Republicans began changing election laws, making it harder to vote. They did so even more vigorously after the Supreme Court overturned a section of the Voting Rights Act, removing federal election oversight that the states, each with a history of obstructing the minority vote, said was no longer needed. Between 2014 and 2016, states deleted almost 16 million people from voter registration lists, purges that accelerated in the last years of the Obama administration, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. States enacted new voter ID laws even as they created more barriers to obtaining this newly required ID. Together, these actions had the cumulative effect of reducing voter participation of marginalized people and immigrants, both of whom were seen as more likely to vote Democrat. A paper found that states were far more likely to enact restrictive voting laws, wrote the commentator Jonathan Chait, if minority turnout in their state had recently increased. Contrary to the wistful predictions of post-racial harmony, the number of hate groups in the United States surged from 602 to more than 1,000 between 2000 and 2010, the middle of Obama's first term in office, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. A 2012 study found that anti-Black attitudes and racial stereotyping rose rather than fell, as some might have hoped, in Obama's first term. The percentage of Americans who expressed explicit anti-Black attitudes ticked upward from 48% in 2008 to 51% in 2012, but the percentage expressing implicit bias rose from 49% to 56%. The study found that higher percentages of white respondents now saw African Americans as violent, irresponsible, and most especially, lazy after his victory, despite, or perhaps because of, the studiously wholesome Black family in the White House, headed by two Ivy League educated parents. With rising resentments, it would not be surprising that attacks on African Americans might not only not have abated, but would worsen under the unprecedented reversal of the social hierarchy. By the second term of the administration in 2015, police were killing unarmed African Americans at 5 times the rate of white Americans. It was a trend that would make police killings a leading cause of death for young African American men and boys, these deaths occurring at a rate of 1 in 1,000 young black men and boys. Early on, Obama had taken symbolic steps to bridge the racial divide. He held a beer summit with Henry Louis Gates Jr. and the officer who had arrested Gates as he tried to enter his home near Harvard, having called the summit after the uproar over his comments that the police had acted stupidly in arresting the Harvard professor. When Trayvon Martin was killed, Obama observed that if he had had a son, the son would have looked like Trayvon. But the caste system rose up, and his approval ratings fell after even these benign gestures. The opposition party stood firm against many of his ambitions and nominees, shutting down the government time and again, refusing to confirm or even consider his Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland. The caste system had handcuffed the president, as it had handcuffed the African Americans face down on the pavement in the videos that had become part of the landscape. It was as if the caste system were reminding everyone of their place, and the subordinate caste in particular, that no matter how the caste of the play was reshuffled, the hierarchy would remain as it always had been. In a paradox of caste, many whites seem to have known this, studies show, seem to have trusted on some unconscious level that the caste system would hold the first black president and the subordinate caste with which he had come to be associated in check. As deeply as some people resented a black man presiding in the Oval Office, most whites in the United States were not overwhelmingly concerned, Jardina writes, that Obama would favor blacks over their own group. Thus, within the parameters in which he was forced to maneuver, he made more headway with race-neutral goals. In so doing, he managed to reshape the country's healthcare system and lead on such issues as climate change, clean energy, gay marriage, sentencing reform, and investigations into police brutality that other administrations might have ignored altogether, while guiding the country out of recession. But accomplishments from those considered to have stepped out of their place often only breed more resentment, in this case, inciting the tremors of discontent among those feeling eclipsed by his very existence. Any upheaval in the universe is terrifying, James Baldwin once wrote, because it so profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. Which is why Obama's presidency and his high approval ratings masked an undercurrent of anxiety about our changing nation, according to Jardina. It hid a swell of resistance to multiculturalism and a growing backlash to immigration. In November 2012, on the day after the first black president won re-election to a second term, Rush Limbaugh, the conservative radio talk show host, went on the air and lamented to his listeners. "I went to bed last night thinking we're outnumbered," Limbaugh said. "I went to bed last night thinking we've lost the country. I don't know how else you look at this." That same day, a troubled 64-year-old man in South Florida took the most extreme action imaginable. In the time leading up to the election, according to police, Henry Hamilton, owner of a tanning salon in Key West, told friends, "If Barack gets reelected, I'm not going to be around." He kept his word. His body was found in his condominium 1.5 days after the returns came in. two prescription bottles sat empty in his dining room. Beside him was a handwritten note demanding that he not be revived and cursing the newly reelected president. Chapter 26. Turning Point and the Resurgence of Caste. In the final breaths of 2015, an influential gathering of political insiders in Washington were seeing in the new year. It was the eve of an election season that was considered of great significance before it had even begun. I felt out of my orbit whenever I was in official Washington, and so I gravitated toward Gwen Ifill, whom I had known for years and had not seen in some time. Back during our days at the New York Times, I had been a narrative writer focused on everyday people rather than the halls of power as she had been, the intuitive empath to her political savant. I went straight up to her. "So," I began, "what are you thinking?" The first seconds of 2016 were approaching, and she knew exactly what I meant. I hesitated to proffer my own opinion at first. Gwen was the beloved co-host of the NewsHour on PBS. She was a long-standing, clear-eyed Washington sage, whom I, along with millions of others, admired for her brilliance and sixth sense, for how she had taken to the sharky waters of the Capitol as if born to it, always rising above it somehow. She was an embed in a political ecosystem that I had little patience for. I didn't know if what I was feeling compelled to say would sound wildly off base or preposterous to someone as steeped in establishment Washington as she was. For some reason, I felt the need to whisper. This was supposed to be a party, after all. Champagne pouring all around us, a celebration to ring in 2016. There were people from the current administration, and perhaps people in the Democratic frontrunner's campaign for all I knew, or in any case, certainly people supporting the frontrunner and expecting a continuing through line of the forward-thinking perspectives carried forth by what would soon be the outgoing administration.